Us, us, sing the red-breast robin of the Sullivans of Ireland. Us, us, cry the skylark and the linnet and the meadow lark. Us, sing the band of wrens singing in the fresh green branches. All join in the dawn chorus. All the best musicians were singers. All the best singers were bards. Hearts held high, who sings away the hag of winter? Who sings the stars down from the darkness? Who sings the sun up into the wind? Who cracks open the dawn? Us, us, sing the blackbird and the thrush. Us, us, sing the red-breast robin. And us, us, sings the band of wrens singing in the fresh green branches. All join in the dawn chorus. All join in the dawn chorus.
Coming up after the news, Sinead Leeson with another edition of The Book Show. This is RTE Radio 1. It's 7 o'clock.
RTE News on Radio 1 with Kate Egan. Good evening. Independent Alliance TD Finian McGrath has said work is continuing to finalise the details of an agreement that could see independent deputies supporting Enda Kenny as Taoiseach. He told RTE News that the Alliance's six TDs are working to try to have an agreement in place within hours or days after the group formally meets Fine Gael again on Monday. He insisted the Alliance TDs remain united in their objectives and will act as one. Fine Gael need at least six more independent TDs to vote for Enda Kenny if he's to be elected Taoiseach next week. The party is understood to be in contact with 14 independent TDs this weekend. It's understood the discussions include setting aside €15 million to try and cut hospital long waiting lists. It's planned for €2,000 a year to be made available in a subvention to try and reduce the cost of childcare. 15% of an increase in rent supplement is also being proposed for some parts of the country, while mortgage interest for first-time buyers will be extended for a further 3 years. That's potentially worth up to €1,800 a year for a couple. Abroad and in Iraq, demonstrators have stormed Parliament in protest against the ongoing deadlock in approving a new cabinet. Hundreds of Shia activists broke through gates of the protected green zone after MPs again failed to convene for a vote. A plaque has been unveiled at the site in Dublin where 16 people were killed during the 1916 Rising. The men and boys died when British Army officers were ordered to clear an area of the North Inner City after a week of fighting. It became known as the North King Street Massacre. Many of the victims were not involved in the fighting and some of their bodies were buried by the troops in cellars and back gardens.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Aer Lingus. Smart likes free Wi-Fi and a lie-flat bed. So for great transatlantic business class travel, smart flies Aer Lingus.
Showers in the east of the country will die out this evening and the early part of the night will be generally dry. Cloud will thicken overnight and rain will spread from the west as winds freshen and back to a southerly direction. Lowest overnight temperatures of between -4 to 7 degrees. And that's all for now. We'll have news again at 8 o'clock.
Kate Egan, this is RTE Radio 1. You're very welcome to our programmes here for Saturday evening, where we've got music through until midnight.
This Saturday night, Cayley House comes to you live from the Community Hall in Fecal in County Clare, where we'll be celebrating 70 years of the Tulla Cayley Band. We'll have music and song from Martin Hayes and Dennis Cahill, Mary McNamara, Sorica and Padraig Costello, the Baruma Trio, Gerard and Emer Coughlin, Helen Hayes, Katie Green and the Tulla Cayley Band. That's Cayley House. Live from Fecal in County Clare this Saturday night, 9 o'clock on RTE Radio 1.
Dingle is celebrating the coming of the May at Féilean na Bealtaine this bank holiday weekend. Some great artists are coming to visit. The young and wonderfully gifted Mahalia will be here, Saint Sister will charm us, and West Kerry natives Lumiere will raise their voices and sing live for you from West Kerry. So join us to welcome in the summer on a very special South Wind Blows this Saturday at 10 here on RTE Radio 1.
The west asleep, the west asleep, alas, the west.
That's coming up just after 10, and in half an hour's time, the poetry programme.
The best way to experience words is to commit them to memory, to allow your mind to be visited by words that you learned many years ago.
We celebrate the poetry of Brendan Kennelly in the Poetry Programme, Saturday at 7:30 on RTE Radio 1.
You're tuned to RTE Radio 1. Now it's time for The Book Show.
This is The Book Show. On tonight's show, artists take inspiration from Irish writers for their work.
So this portrait of Joyce took on a life of its own.
And Pádraic O'Donnell on his new book, The Maker of Swans.
They had fled to Paris first, he and Mr. Crowe. There, he had been admitted to another world.
Well, last week's show was from the Kirch Festival in Galway, and while we were there, we brought together two writers whose books both deal with friendship. Rachel Glaser's Paulina and Fran, and Belinda McKeown's Tender. Belinda McKeown reads here from Tender, and this bit is where the main character, Catherine, is looking at her friend James through a camera.
She took the Rolleiflex. It was lighter than she had expected, but sturdy, its silver dials jutting out against her palms, its pebbled black plastic surface pleasingly rough against her fingertips. She looked down through the neat square chute which topped it, and she staggered in surprise a moment. The picture was sharp and clear and moving like a tiny television in her hands, and in it was a tiny, frowning James, now a grinning James, now a James who was calling out to her, waving at her, saying her name. She found herself staring at this James. She found herself transfixed by him. He was just the same as the real James, as the James who stood not 2 feet away from her, but he was different. When she moved, he moved. When she turned one of the dials on the side of the camera, he went out of focus a moment. But when she turned it once more, he was back again, crisp and perfect and real.
Belinda, in both your and Rachel's books, we're dealing with friendships. And Catherine and James that we meet in Tender have a very specific kind of friendship. Tell me about it.
Well, they're very young when they meet. They're 18, 19. And they form that kind of friendship that's only, I think, really possible at that age, when you form this really intense connection with somebody very quickly. So you go from zero to obsession, essentially, very quickly. And they're the kind of friends who want to stay up all night talking, don't want to go to sleep because there's still too much talking to be done. At least that's how it begins. And the novel is essentially the story of what happens to their friendship as the various pieces of emotional and cultural baggage that they're both carrying start to come in pretty heavily on that friendship and turn it into something else.
It would be a very different kind of friendship as well if you had this book was written and they were both in their 40s or their 50s. It's that very specific time in life when things are, it's everything is really intense and ratcheted up.
Yeah, I mean, you're still a teenager. They are still teenagers. I mean, they're in college, or Catherine's in college. At that time of your life, you're kind of coming, a lot of the time you're still coming out of your adolescence. You're coming out of your family home almost, and you're looking for a new family very, very intently. And so the people that you form the bonds with, they become your life in a way that in your 30s or 40s, you don't have the time or the headspace, and you kind of want more privacy by then. But at that time, you know, I mean, when I was that age, I was living in a flat in Dublin with 8 other people, and I never noticed that there were too many of us for any of us to be able to breathe. That was wonderful, and that was just what we wanted from each other.
Rachel, the characters in your book, Paulina and Fran, which is the title of the book, who are these girls?
Paulina and Fran is about two girls who meet at art school and form a friendship, which gets complicated when one of them starts dating the other's ex-boyfriend, and their own friendship goes through many stages.
To get a sense of who Paulina and Fran are, maybe you'd read a bit from the book for us and tell us a bit about this section.
So at this part in the book, it's in the first chapter, and they're at a dance party at the school they go to, and two boys have just danced into a mirror and it's broken and shattered, and Paulina is staring at Fran, who's dancing in front of the mirror, and they've never spoken before. Fran's green eyes looked lost, light curly hair whipped against her forehead. There was something innovative in the layout of her face, but her expression showed no understanding of this. Fran was absorbed in her jagged reflection. She wore a short dress with tiny hearts on it and a man's flannel. Paulina stared, realizing Fran was friends with one of Paulina's enemies. Paulina couldn't remember which girl. Her idea of Fran darkened. She wanted to be her, or be with her, or destroy her.
And that was Rachel P. Glaser reading there from Paulina and Fran. That line is really quite devastating, the idea that she wanted to be her, be with her, destroy her. And that sort of relates to what Belinda was saying about that intensity. It's a very consuming kind of friendship that they go on to develop.
Yeah, I think in hearing Belinda talk about her characters, I think it's a similar time for these characters. I think that moment of connecting with someone and getting to know them and being so intrigued by them, it's sort of excruciating because it's so powerful.
There's a sense, Belinda, that when you chose James Salter's the epigraph at the start of the book, which is great, that idea that you can't have two friends like this, there's only one. Why is Catherine so relentless in it? She's so singular about James. Where does that come from?
I think she finds something in him that she doesn't have in herself. He's very confident in almost every way except one crucial way. He has a huge amount of charisma, and he can talk to other people and basically conduct himself in the world in a way that Catherine can't yet. She's younger than him, but she's also much younger in her ways, and she doesn't really know how to talk to people. So James sort of, he becomes friends with everyone he meets. He's a whirlwind. And Catherine sees that, and she wants some of that for herself. And that becomes part of her reason for wanting him as a friend and eventually as a lover.
What's fascinating, I think, in friendships, real or fictional, is the idea that you have this very intense friendship that's almost like a love affair, but then it tips over, and then there's a competitive side to it, and there's something very fierce about it. There's a lot for a writer to get into with that idea that it can be so brilliant and then it goes wrong.
Yeah, I think I found that in my own life, that it's hard to make sense of something after it changes, and that any sort of connection you can keep with that person, even if it's not communicating, even if it's getting involved in some part of life that they're also involved in, there's just still a draw to things that ended ambiguously.
Everybody has one of these friendships in their past. Was it one that was really intense and then something awful happened?
Yeah, I definitely have a couple. Nothing awful happened except growing up, you know, and except life. Life gets in the way and you realize, oh my God, it's 10 years since I've seen that person who not very long, or it feels like not very long ago, I couldn't go 10 minutes without talking to them. I mean, think of the phone calls we had at that age, you know. You'd have the phone out in the hall for 2 hours talking to somebody, 3 hours. You just couldn't stop talking to them. But yeah, maybe something happens, you know. Emotions are running very high, and so it's pretty easy for something that feels catastrophic to happen, even if it isn't. I mean, I think a lot about that Elizabeth Bishop poem, One Art, The Art of Losing Isn't Hard to Master, and then the whole poem is about small things that are lost. I mean, that's often what friendships can feel like. You can lose each other over something very small and then sort of spend a long time clawing your way back towards each other.
What Belinda's saying, that it's not necessarily that something catastrophic happens, but that just feeling differently about someone that you felt so intensely about before can feel like something's wrong with you or something's wrong with them or that things weren't supposed to change. And I think all relationships have this sort of like memory capsule of the height of them, and it's hard to know which things you should allow to change and which things you have to find your way back to.
There's a sense, though, with Pauline and Fran that, you know, things do go wrong in their relationship, and yet they have moved on, they have grown up, but they've never really gotten over each other.
With them, I think it's this idea that they never got to see there's a certain way they could have been together, and they never got to explore it. So maybe they use it as an excuse when they're not satisfied with the way their current lives are, that they think they took the wrong path.
Belinda, with Catherine and James, although this is an incredibly intense and close friendship, I wondered when I was reading the book as well, is there a sense that they're not good for each other and that they're keeping each other from other friendships, from possible romantic situations, and that they think they're great for each other, but they're not necessarily?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That was definitely one of the things I wanted to explain. What happens when a friendship tips over into codependency, into a need for each other that is no longer healthy because it's coming from, you know, deep unmet needs in the respective selves. So James needs Catherine because James is a young gay man who's just starting to come out very slowly and very tentatively, and he's afraid. And so Catherine is somebody that helps him to hide in a certain way. Catherine needs James because he has all of that charisma and he has all of that confidence, but also she needs him, she needs to hide in him as well. So they start to depend on each other in ways that, you know, may begin innocently, but as things deepen and as emotions become deeper and as, you know, certain, I think, you know, I wanted to think a lot in the book about inherited ways of thinking and inherited ways of behaving, not just from, you know, a family context, from a cultural context. And it's set in the 90s. So James is one of the first, he's part of the first generation, really, of young people who could be out in Ireland without it being illegal. So it's a very charged context, you know. So in that way, Catherine really wants to be a good friend to him. But for various reasons, including the country that she grew up in, she's not very good at being a good friend to him. And that's, it does turn into a type of catastrophe.
It was also, I found it really striking to be reading this book last year just as Ireland was having the same-sex marriage referendum. And obviously, that's great timing for this book, but you couldn't possibly have known. How was it for you, you know, immersing yourself in this time when Ireland had a very different attitude?
Yeah, it felt a bit surreal, actually. But the thing was, I had finished the book a year earlier, and believe it or not, it's still, you know, that year before the referendum was in itself a big turning point in Ireland. So even a year previously, in some way, it didn't feel all that distant from the late 90s. But by May 2015, which was just when the book came out, and the referendum was on the 22nd of May, I mean, I don't know, it was just... It was hard to believe the change and the changed country that we seemed to be walking through on that weekend. It really was an extraordinary day. At the same time, I've gotten, you know, one of the lovely things about being on social media is that you hear directly from readers, which I'm sure Rachel does as well. And I've been really surprised by how many, you know, young gay men and women have written to me, Irish gay men and women have written to me, you know, people who are 18 and 19 now saying, this is my life, like this is what it's still like. And that bothers me quite a lot, because it shouldn't be still like that for somebody who's 19 and just coming out in rural Ireland. So, you know, a lot has changed, but there's a lot still out there to happen.
People might look at both of these books and say that it's a story about friendship, but when I was reading it, I felt that both books were stories of obsession.
I definitely agree with that. I think friendship in general is something that people sometimes use to sell books or to push them in a category, but I feel like my characters, to call it a friendship is sort of to simplify it, and that they're really only friends for maybe a chapter or two, and then they're more like enemies or just like ghosts to each other.
Yeah, I think that all of my favorite books about friendship, and I, you know, Rachel is going to think I'm just flattering her here, but Paulina and Fran is one of my favorite books about friendship. I absolutely loved it when I read it last summer. But all of my favorite books about friendship, like Edna O'Brien's The Country Girls, Laurie Moore's Who Will Run the Frog Hospital, I'm also thinking of Patti Smith's memoir, Just Kids. They're all more like love stories than they are friendship stories. I mean, friendship, as Rachel said, it almost becomes a bland description of a relationship once you're writing about it. A novel is a whole world. I mean, you put two people together in the pages of a novel, they become each other's whole world, for better or for worse. So maybe it's more like friendship as marriage.
And thanks there. Belinda McKeown's Tender is published by Picador, and Rachel B. Glazer's Paulina and Fran is published by Granta Books. Now, the Dublin Painting and Sketching Club's annual exhibition next month has the theme 100 Years of Irish Writing. Two of its members, Aidan Hickey and Kate Bedell, spoke to us about the writers that inspired their work.
Crazy Jane is somebody who's been through the feminist wars. She's been around since the 60s. She's now physically very, not exactly frail, but she's rather emaciated. But she's still wearing the garb that was very popular with such ladies back then, which is a kind of dungarees, denim dungarees, which is both concealing and revealing in the way that she wears it. I chose W.B. Yeats as the inspiration for my paintings. One of the first that I began to work on was the poem Crazy Jane and the Bishop. It starts with Crazy Jane saying, "I met the bishop on the road, and much said he and I." So it's about a conversation between the two of them. She is stating her love of physical, sexual activity. The bishop, on the other hand, is denouncing this and stating the value of the spiritual life and condemning her effectively to hell and damnation. for the life that she's lived, because she's now obviously old, and he's very ready to condemn her in the most sort of direct terms, almost mocking her physical frailty. But she, on the other hand, comes back with the fairly outrageous point that sexuality and defecation or whatever is on the same area of the human body. And it's clearly offensive to the bishop to have to deal with this idea. A woman can be proud and stiff when on love intent, but love has pitched his mansion in the place of excrement. And it goes on into the other poems. I mean, I think there are about 8 poems in the series that he wrote.
Somehow I stumbled across Finnegan's Wake and heard a little piece of it read. And something went ping in me and I thought, I understand this. And I thought, OK, so there's a different way to get into this book rather than just reading it. So this portrait of Joyce took on a life of its own. I was just fascinated by the fact that the end of the book finishes in the middle of a sentence, and the start of the book opens in the middle of a sentence, and it's the same sentence. And I suppose as an artist, a visual artist, I wanted to physically combine those two. So I actually took the text from the end of the book and the beginning of the book and married them together in Joyce's face, in his portrait. It turned into a landscape, the landscape of the rocks at the 40-foot just behind Joyce's tower. And because Finnegan's Wake is set at night, I set the scene at night. And his craggy profile worked beautifully with the cragginess of the rocks. I wanted the effect of watercolour and the movement of the watercolour to bring forward Joyce's ghost. His spirit was still there.
Story in modern art was completely verboten, I mean, for a very long time. I have taken to working from literature, from Joyce, from Yeats, as a way of finding the ideas and themes that interest ordinary folk and trying to find a visual way of representing those ideas.
I'm a case in point where I have not read the entire of Finnegan's Wake, but I'm taking parts of it relevant to my painting as an artist, to my experience as a woman, and it is such a rich environment to be in, to work from literary themes.
And the 138th annual exhibition of the Dublin Painting and Sketching Club is on in the Concourse Gallery. That's in County Hall in Dunleary in Dublin. And that's from May 9th to Saturday, May 21st. There's also an open submission process on that exhibition. So for more information, go to dublinpaintingandsketchingclub.ie. Now, Pádraic O'Donnell's debut novel, The Maker of Swans, starts with a bang, literally starts with a murder, and involves the character Mr. Crow. So Pádraic joins me in studio now. So let's start with Mr. Crow. Who is he?
So Mr. Crow belongs to an ancient order of sorts whose nature is kept mysterious. In that role, Mr. Crow has been sought out by the great and the good, and also by aspiring literary types, struggling writers. In that way, he's enriched himself and lives in a very lavish manner. But he's a dissolute character. He has a tendency to get into trouble, as you say at the opening of the book. He's got into trouble in a rather spectacular way. He's dealt with a love rival in his usual intemperate manner. That will have consequences that play out throughout the remainder of the book.
One person who does try to help him clear up that rather messy murder is Eustace. And who is Eustace and who is Clara? These are the kind of the very central people in his life who live in this big mansion with him that you mentioned.
Yeah, Eustace is easy, I suppose. He's his longstanding servant and major domo. And he's been in service with Mr. Crow for a very long time. And it falls to Eustace almost always to clean up Mr. Crow's various messes, of which this is probably the most spectacular to date. Clara is slightly more mysterious. She's introduced as Mr. Crow's young charge. Her history isn't immediately explained. Like Mr. Crow, she has certain gifts, except that in Clara's case, she has yet to discover their nature and certainly their extent.
We often forget that people in service have a life of their own before they come to their present jobs. And Eustace does have a backstory, had a life before he meets Mr. Crow. Let's hear a little bit from that backstory.
It was something he became accustomed to. They had fled to Paris first, he and Mr. Crow, when that city was in the last of its true glory. There he had been admitted to another world, to a world of carriage rides and opera houses, of scandals whispered behind silk-gloved fingers, a world of sonatas and cigar smoke, of toothless princesses and jasmine-scented whores. It was a world where he knew nothing, but he learned quickly. He was shown without introduction into the lower rooms of half the fine houses in the Septième. While he waited for his master to emerge from the salon, the boudoir above, he listened to the talk of the servants, even when there was hardly a word of it that he understood. He kept his eyes on his untouched absinthe, and he tried to pick the sense from the noise. He learned. He stood with the valets in the passageways, or among the grooms in the stables, and his education came without order or sequence. He learned the word for horseshit, and the word for iron, the words for lice and sores, for maidenhood and stillbirth. But he listened, and he learned.
And that was Porrick O'Donnell reading there from The Maker of Swans. Why did you tell most of the story from Eustace's point of view? Because we do hear a lot from him in this book.
We do, although I think it bears pointing out that, in fact, the chapters are equally divided between Eustace and Clara. I felt, I suppose, that in many ways it was Eustace's story and Clara's, and not really Mr. Crow's, although, you know, I think people have picked up on him as a, you know, he's a kind of Byronic character, and you know, he's attractive in that way. You know, he tends to hog the limelight as a character, but it is, as you say, narrated from Eustace's point of view, and I guess that's because you know what's interesting in fiction is when people change. You know, when people are placed under under stresses of various kinds and adapt to those, and you know, whereas Mr. Crow is kind of recalcitrant and very much set in his ways, Eustace comes from quite humble origins, you know, lives on his wits, and changes a great deal over the course of the novel, wants to change more, of course, and feels very much that he's failed, but, you know, has a strong desire to change and to do good.
Like many people, I first discovered you via Twitter and social media, and you started to tell these sort of Twitter short stories. So what prompted them, and how did that lead to people then thinking, you know, have you got a book in you? Are you writing? Were people asking you that?
That's an interesting question. I mean, Twitter was certainly formative in all of this. And I guess one of the wonderful things about Twitter, and something that I think its detractors don't appreciate sometimes, is that it's a wonderfully meritocratic place. You know, on Twitter, it doesn't matter if you're nobody, as long as you can tell a decent joke, because jokes, as you know, are really central to the form, you know, and I think Twitter prizes wit in a way that I think is admirable. You know, as a, if you can do a certain kind of one-liner well, you know, I'm not sure quite how well I do them, you know, you can find yourself in conversation with almost anyone, and certainly almost anyone from publishing, because, you know, Twitter is the lifeblood now of publishing, as you know. So it was in that way, it was very much an organic thing. It wasn't planned in any kind of cynical way, and as you say, you know, the certain jokes grew legs and, you know, evolved into kind of series of improvised fiction, you know, kind of busking, except with stories, which were done live. It was instructive, you know, it was like serving a kind of apprenticeship, and it instilled a kind of discipline, serving that time.